So I'm happy to introduce you to Dino, who works for Tarent. Tarent is one of this conference's partners, so we are quite glad to have him here. And he will talk to us about how to eliminate database bottlenecks by using embedded databases. So let's get right to it.
Hi, I hope everyone can hear me quite well. If you have any questions, please just write them down in the chat. And after my talk, I will get to answering them. And also, you can write them down afterwards, and we can have a discussion then later on. Due to my setup, I cannot see the chat messages while I'm giving the talk, but afterwards, I can see them all in the chat. So let's start. Welcome to my talk. It's about scalability, microservice scalability. And at first, I gave it this title, Eliminating the Database Bottleneck for Proper Horizontal Scalability. And I now gave it a subtitle, or how I should have thought of a better title. So it's quite a long title, and the talk changed a small bit, so it's a bit more general, but I'll get to that in a minute. First, a few words about me and my company. I'm Dino, Dino Romanovic. I'm an IT consultant, systems architect, developer, and I'm Golang, a programming language trainer. Feel free to visit my homepage. Follow me on GitHub, where I have lots of unfinished projects, and add me on LinkedIn or Xing. I work for Tarent Solutions GmbH. We're offering custom IT solutions for over 20 years. We're doing consulting, agile development, coaching, agile coaching. We do working with IoT, AI, and other emerging technologies. So take a look at our homepage, Tarent.de. If you want a job, take a look too. And if you need some help with IT projects or want to cooperate, contact us. Or just contact me. I can then pass it on. So let's get to the talk. What's this about? So in the beginning, I said that I want to that the talk's a bit more general than the title might suggest. And basically, I want you to take away or go out from the talk with two new things you've learned. So one thing is a new design pattern for microservice architectures, and the other thing is a perspective on software and systems architecture or scalability in general. I hope you will at least learn one of these two things, or we'll see in the end. We'll start with a small story. So to explain what scalability is or why it's important, we're going to look at the life cycle of a product or platform or a web page, whatever. So a software in general. At first, our happy little program is born. So it's small, it's beautiful. A few developers are working on it, and everything works out, right? If you work in a big corporation, usually you can skip this part and skip on a few slides ahead, but maybe the rest is interesting to you too. So in the beginning, everything is under control. As you can see, we have in this example, it's a program which can list great beers. And in this example, we just have an object with beer and maybe something to an API for beers, and that's it basically. So we can understand our program. It's quite organized. A few developers are working on it. Everything's great, and we start adding some features to it. So life's good. Maybe we want to, I don't know, add a comment feature, or we want to add possibilities to add more beer varieties. So we need to add more features to our program. And the product or program becomes a success. So we need to ship more features and we need to handle more customers. So what do you need to do? You need to start scaling up to achieve this. So you want to, in general, you want to deliver features faster. And for this, you need to scale up. There are different kinds of scalability. And I'm still going to talk about the one on the left first, and later on we'll get to the one on the right. To deliver more features in a shorter amount of time, you need more people, of course. And later on we'll get to why you need more hardware or infrastructure or anything like that. First, we'll talk about scaling people. So, of course, to get more features, we need more people, and we need more people to write more code, of course. But as many of you probably know, if they've worked with lots of people, adding people to a project doesn't always mean that the project is going to get delivered faster or that features are going to be implemented faster. So this scaling is not linear. More people can increase communication issues. So if you add more developers to a team or more development teams, this can lead to onboarding. People need to understand the code base, or responsibilities need to be split up. So teams have to find their place, and this can slow down development initially. So more people can slow down development at first. But of course, there are ways to manage things like these, and there are also management tools to scale people up, but I'm not going to talk about them specifically. Things like Agile or Scrum, I'm more focused on the technical side of things today. So let's look what happens if we add more people to an application, more developers who produce more code. In the end, our program starts to become complex, and this is not necessarily a bad thing because, of course, more features require more code, and this class diagram, which omits the methods and functions and so on, and fields, this class diagram, for example, is the class diagram of Spring Boot. So the software here is actually organized quite nicely, but it's getting big, of course. So even if it's organized quite nicely and it doesn't have too many levels of abstractions, still it means that probably not that many developers completely understand it. So a program starts to get complex, and the more developers we add, the more complex it will get. So our program has grown quite a bit. Our small kitten and cat has now become a tiger, and we need to look at what kinds of issues this can cause. If you scale people, you need to pay attention to design. So you can scale developers in such big applications, and you can also prevent the developers from getting in each other's way. So good architecture, monolith architecture, and good programming principles can keep everything organized. Good principles, for example, are don't repeat yourself, dry, you ain't gonna need it, Yagni, keep it simple, stupid, kiss, or domain-driven design. Also, architecture concepts like layered architectures or something are very helpful to organize big code bases. So all in all, even if your program is really big and your code base is growing a lot, you can still manage it if you pay great attention to architecture, design, and best practices or programming principles. But another dimension is more difficult to scale in these kinds of scenarios. So if we want to, if we develop more features, we also want to deploy them faster. So we want our customer or the user, whatever, to use them faster. And if you have a lot of teams and one big code base, it becomes difficult to deploy or roll out those features fast. If any one team deploys, changes other teams made get deployed too. So for example, if you have a main branch in a Git repository or something and multiple teams add code to it and want to deploy this code, every team that deploys will deploy all other changes that were added to the code from other teams. You have some possibilities to prevent that again. So you have complex workflows like Git Flow maybe or other workflows for teams to prevent deployments incidentally deploying stuff from other teams. And also you can communicate a lot to organize this. For example, if one team changes a central part of the application, some API, a function everybody uses, this has to be coordinated with all other teams. Or it needs to be versioned in some library, et cetera, et cetera. So in conclusion, the more teams you have, the slower deployments become, or the more effort deployments become. And the greater the software or the more teams there are, the steeper the increase in effort or time you need is. So what we need to do usually, or what we usually do, is that we break up this piece of software into smaller parts. So we're breaking up the monolith. For the people who didn't hear it before, monolith is a description for a big piece of software for a product which just consists of one big piece of software. Usually it's used in the backend context for web platforms and stuff like this. Our goal here is to break up the monolith so we can scale deployments or scale people while retaining fast deployment speed. When we break up such a monolith, usually we do it by, or nowadays we do it by splitting it into microservices oftentimes. So the code is split into separate microservices, and these microservices usually have to be manageable by a single team. They need to be split into a problem domain. So for example, if we have a web platform like a video platform, you could generate services for posts or comments and one service for videos. Every one of these services needs to be manageable by a single team, and it should use its own database. It should be a team could manage multiple microservices, but a microservice should not be managed by multiple teams to prevent the communication issues and efforts we just talked about. The same goes for the database, so that database schema changes or something don't need to be communicated a lot. So we use microservices mainly as a way to organize developers in teams and to allow us to deploy often, even if we have a lot of teams. So now everything looks good again. We split up our big application, and let's say we have three teams and we've created three services. We have some servers, I don't know, which delivers the front end, and this service needs to call to other microservices to get data, and everything's fine, right? We have three databases. Every team can work for itself, and the world's okay again. We have control. But of course, we are adding more features. The software will grow quite a bit more. And probably if you work in a big corporation, you'll start with this state. So you have a number of teams, a big code base, or many microservices. And it starts to look like this. So this is still fairly simple, but illustrates the point I want to make. We're starting to add more microservices. And if you look at it, I think my laser pointer should be visible. If you look at it, these three services on the top are the ones we started with. And after adding some features, we add more microservices, all solving a specific problem. For example, you are starting to add a shop to your beer platform, and there could be a service for prices, one for stocks, maybe some descriptions or something. And the initial service delivering the front end starts to call one service, which will aggregate some data needed for the front end. And then the call goes on. So, okay, I want a page on this kind of beer. Then this service starts collecting data from the prices service, maybe from some description service. And in turn, maybe the service needs to make some calls again. So what we now see is that those microservices start to get dependencies too, similar to the code dependencies we had. And for one feature, a call could go through this route. For another feature, a call could go through this route. And all in all, for our services, this means that we have created dependencies between these services. And even worse, in this case, we've created a circular dependency. So if any one of these services fails, the whole call graph for the upper service is broken and we have an error if just one of these services fails. So let's look at it in another way. We started to shift complexity from code to infrastructure, whereas we had class dependencies before, for example, or function dependencies, depending on your programming language. We now have dependencies between components of an infrastructure. So we have repository dependencies on one hand. So for example, multiple microservices depend on a library they all use. And also we have call dependencies. So microservices call each other to get information via HTTP or REST calls. And these dependencies are very brittle because they are synchronous and deployments can start to break stuff again. So if, for example, my product API service gets deployed and the API is changed in such a way that it is incompatible, suddenly my deployment breaks other teams' services, maybe. So I need to start versioning APIs, and usually this is done via semantic versioning, which is quite nice. But this kind of design becomes very important. Also, architecture is really important now again. Now we talk with different terms, maybe. So one thing is hypermedia as the engine of application state, which is a pattern you can use to organize and structure your microservice landscape. Or you can use tooling like service meshes to reduce the effort to maintain and develop such a microservice landscape, etc. So still, we can keep scaling people if we choose careful design, if we pay attention to versioned APIs, and if we use technologies like service mesh or patterns like HTOAS. But in the end, this means that design and communication efforts are increasing a lot. And similar to the monolithic software we had, we see that this effort increase, in my experience, is not quite linear. So to keep synchronous microservice systems manageable, we need to apply a lot of duct tape. Yes. So I call it duct tape because these things like service meshes or synchronous microservice patterns do minimize the problems we have, but they do not solve the problems fundamentally. To solve these problems I mentioned fundamentally, we need to start decoupling microservices. I'll start by explaining what decoupling means. So the word coupling, or a coupling, is the thing that holds two train wagons together, right? So if these disconnect, this is a bad thing because the train wouldn't be complete anymore and it would lose a lot of cargo. But in software development, decoupling usually is a good thing because what we see is if we have two microservices and they use a lot of different APIs from the other microservice or maybe of each other's APIs, they are quite dependent on each other. So if this microservice fails, for example, essentially this microservice will fail too. There are patterns to mitigate this, like circuit breaker, but in the end, those won't save us from failure. They just minimize the effect this failure has on our system. So we start to decrease these dependencies. At first, maybe we want to minimize the coupling. So if this just one service uses the other and not both use each other, maybe failure rates will get smaller. And in the end, we want to get to a state, ideally, it's not always possible, where the services are not really coupled. They have some sort of connection because they need the other services' data. But ideally, this service could fail and the other service could still function. And in the last years, we've started to implement this using messaging systems or event architecture. And I will explain such a system. I'll try to explain it very shortly in 2 minutes. So what I usually use, but there are similar technologies out there, is Kafka. Kafka is an event streaming platform. And what it has is it has fast sequential reads and writes. So it can very performantly read sequential data. Whole blocks of data in a very short amount of time, and it can also write them. It takes any object in any format, so you can write anything to it, and it accesses asynchronously. What this means is, in fact, let's look at an example. Let's say I have a product information management system, some software where people can add descriptions to beer or maybe even prices, and I have some microservice that just dumps this data in such a topic of Kafka. And the data is now present in Kafka. Kafka is highly scalable and highly available. And now, instead of my other microservice who needs this data directly calling the other service, I now can just get the data from Kafka. And even if one microservice fails, the other can operate like nothing happened and everything works great. Also, this of course goes for multiple microservices. So let's say I get prices from a enterprise resource planning system. Those get dumped into a prices topic and my last microservice aggregates those two data pools, if you want to call them, or topics, and it can deliver pages for a web shop. So this decouples the infrastructure dependency of one microservice to the other and allows us to have a more robust service landscape. Let's look at a example which is based on a few projects I've been involved in, but is not any one project in particular. Let's look at a mid-sized e-commerce or retail platform. We have multiple teams working on multiple problem domains. So for example, one team is responsible for payment services. One team is responsible for some content management system and some microservices that are important in this context. One team is important for the web shop, and one team manages data, or multiple teams manage data from the enterprise resource planning system. Every team can use synchronous microservices in their own problem domain because they don't need to synchronize with other teams when changes happen because they have control over all these microservices. But if there's data that other teams might need, they will just dump it in Kafka. And from there on, other teams are independent and can just pull this data in and then work with it. So effectively, we've reduced the amount of communication and planning it takes for multiple teams to work on this, and also we reduced the effort we need to invest in things like versioning or something. So of course, still, if major changes happen to the data formats, we should dump them in another topic, but still, our old developers can just consume the old topic until they've upgraded to the new data model. So all in all, we've solved all our problems, right? Well, maybe it's not that simple. So of course, we can still scale people up this way as everything works nicely, but maybe it's not quite perfect. So maybe we see a pattern here. How things develop. Let's get philosophical for just a small bit, just two slides. So I think that Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel would have been a great systems architect, and I'll try to explain in a few words. So it's difficult to find a one-line quote from him which explains all these things, but I'll try. So he said, there's nothing which is not an intermediate state between being and nothing. In the Science of Logic, 1812. What this essentially means is that everything has the potential to change into another state. And these changes, and I'll oversimplify because this is not a lecture on Hegel or anything. This means that quantitative changes result in qualitative changes at some point. Well, big words, but in the end, this means, based on an example, that, for example, increasing the temperature of water will lead to a sudden change. It starts to boil. And scaling is a mitigation strategy. We try to keep the water from boiling, or we try to keep our services from failing, our system from breaking. And different aspects of a system can start to boil. So, for example, if you look at code complexity, in a monolithic architecture, at some point, this will lead to feature and deployment frequency congestion, which means that people can, deployments happen less frequently and features get rolled out slower because there's such a high amount of synchronization and organization effort. Then for lots of synchronous microservices, this can mean that at some point it's very expensive to design the system or keep it functional, and also the communication overhead can become quite large. So we need to look at every solution with this perspective, I think, and on our problem, on our service, on our system now, we can take a look and see that a lot of scaled microservices, a lot of load on a scaled microservice can lead to exploding database response times, cost, complexity, or everything. I'll show it in the visual example in just a second. So what we're doing now is that we are starting to look at scalability from a performance or infrastructure or hardware perspective. We've handled people. Now we need to look at other boiling points. Let's look at the boiling point where the state or our system could break. So based from the example for a few slides ago, we see that we have a service which is accessible to users from the outside world. And since we needed to scale up people because our application became quite popular or successful, this also means that our user base increased quite a lot. And this problem would also apply to monolithic architectures or synchronous, completely synchronous architectures. We see that a lot of people start making requests to our services. We can scale up our microservices, which is nice, but currently they're all accessing a single database. And in this lies the potential of a fail, of a breakage, of an explosion as pictured by the bomb. And how can we mitigate this boiling point? We can scale the database. So different database technologies have the possibility to scale them horizontally, which is a very good long-term solution. But it needs specialized knowledge, usually. So you'd need a database administrator who's really proficient in the database technology. And it also usually has quite high initial costs. So you need to pay for a database cluster instead of a single database. But in the long term, with a lot of load, this is a very good solution. We need to, or we can scale up hardware. This is a very quick solution. You just use a bigger machine. If this is enough for a long time, great, just do it. But there are limited possibilities because they are not infinitely bigger machines usually. And also, you do not gain any guarantees about high availability. So your system can still fail. You can optimize performance, which is really great. And it's a great cost reduction tool for high traffic services. But you can only do so much. So if you've optimized it to the highest amount possible, there are still physical limits. You cannot optimize more than is possible. So maybe there is a possibility to allow us to scale microservices linearly. So just scale them up without having to worry too much about the database behind them. And indeed, there is. And this is the pattern I want you to see. You can just use local or embeddable databases. These databases usually are used in, for example, app development for smartphones or for local development where you just need some database to test. These databases are either local databases that host their files on the local hard drive. So this is very cheap, but it's limited by file I/O. Sorry. So this means your database is only as fast as the underlying hard drive. But they are quite simple, especially because many of those are embeddable databases that can be integrated into your code without any HTTP calls or similar, right? So it's just a program call. You skip network traffic, and it's very easy to program because you don't have to call any APIs, or you can just use a library which is part of your programming language. And some of these are also in-memory databases, building up a structure in the RAM. They're extremely fast because they're working on the RAM, but they can get expensive for big data sets because you need RAM for them. Some of these technologies are RocksDB, which is the thing with the Gepard, I think, or Leopard, I don't know. H2, which is an in-memory SQL database. LMDB, or LevelDB are key value stores. Maps, basically, or you could just use a map in your code, right? Key value, and that's it. So if you have a simple data structure, this might just be enough. My favorite is Bbolt or BoltDB, which I've linked here on GitHub. And in the end, the most popular one is SQL SQLite. And those actually are a good fit for this problem, even if they are not, if their intention even if it's not intentional. So every microservice instance could have or has its own local file-based or in-memory database. This is a great solution for small to medium data sets. You can scale in a linear fashion. So if you scale up 5 microservices, you will have 5 databases, and so on and so forth. The truth is persisted in Kafka or your event streaming system, whichever it is. Your microservices will reach consistency eventually. So this solution might not be a good fit for financial data, like for microservices in a banking environment, but for most use cases, this is quite nice. And they're very cheap because you basically just need space on a hard drive for a data set or for small data sets, just RAM, which is cheaper than buying a database cluster and managing it. But again, if we keep our perspective, this has a different boiling point. So if data sets start to grow, they grow for all instances of a service because every microservice now has its own database. So if my data set becomes quite big, it does so for all microservices. And at this point, I need to reevaluate and think about scaling a real database technology. So let's look what happens. Let's look at what happens. In the end, we'll have multiple microservices, each with its own database. And no matter how many users we get, we can just keep on scaling and we won't have any issues as long as the data set is not too big. So for example, if I have article or product data, if your shop is not Amazon, then probably this could work quite well because you will have a few thousand or 100,000 products, and this is maybe, I don't know, a few 100 megabytes, and this will work out and it won't grow significantly in the future. So you can just keep this technology. You won't need a database cluster or a database administrator who can handle it. And the development team doesn't need to communicate to implement this solution usually. So basically that's it. Thank you for listening. I'll look at the questions in a minute. I want you to take away the two things. Think about systems as boiling pots. So look at every aspect of a system and the context it lives in to decide where it could break. And for your next microservice, consider embeddable local or in-memory databases instead of a big database cluster. And I see that I forgot an arrow, but it doesn't matter.